Good morning, everyone. We'll get started with the second case on our calendar today, which is A20-0718, Butler and Allen, PA versus Ronald William Kammuller. This case is being heard by Zoom oral argument today. The same procedural rules apply to this Zoom oral argument as apply to our oral arguments in the courtroom. The arguments being held by Zoom due to the pandemic situation and in accordance with pandemic-related court orders. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The marshal will be keeping time. Hopefully you can see his phone in one of your screens, and that will show the prior to starting your argument, your primary argument, it will show 15 minutes of time on there. If we do happen to have any technical difficulties, I will ask the marshal to stop the clock to make sure you don't lose any time. The oral argument is being recorded by the Court of Appeals. Just a friendly reminder that other recordings are not permitted without prior permission from the Court of Appeals. So with that, we can get started. I'll ask counsel to please identify yourself and the party you represent so we have that for purposes of our recording. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gregory Hudella. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Ronald Kammuller.
Tim Martin, Your Honor, for the respondent.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gregory Hudella, the attorney for appellant Ronald Kammuller. The issue at bar before this court is not as complicated as it appears. Appellant brought a motion to dismiss before the lower court for insufficient service of process. Respondent in its briefing only offers evidence of the appellant's place of residence. Appellant is not arguing that the substantive basis for personal jurisdiction of the court does not exist. Appellant has never briefed the court in that regard at all. Appellant is arguing that the procedural basis for personal jurisdiction was not met to confer jurisdiction of the court in the first place. The basis of appellant's argument is that Rule 4.04, service by publication, requires three duties of respondent. They must file an affidavit by the attorney that shall state the existence of one of the enumerated cases set forth in Rule 404. It also shall state that the defendant has left the state or remains concealed therein to avoid personal service. And finally, it shall state that the summons and complaint has been mailed to the last known address of the defendant. The respondent kind of met the requirements, but falls short in this case. Respondent filed an affidavit where two of the three requirements are entirely missing in the four corners of the document. In particular, the attorney affidavit does not assert that appellant's state of domicile or that the summons and complaint had been mailed. Even if respondent can prove by preponderance of the evidence that appellant resides in Minnesota or is domiciled here, that is entirely irrelevant to the arguments of appellant.
Mr. Hudella, we may have to come back to that, but just to get to the issue of mailing, your client does not disagree. I assume the record shows an affidavit of mailing, which indeed indicates mailing at that address. If I understand correctly, am I correct on that point?
What I can speak to at this point is that my client did receive in the mail documents from the documents of a summons and complaint.
Well, but beyond that, I mean, the record does indicate an affidavit of mailing. I understand your argument, and I've got it in front of me, which indicates that it was mailed to that same address. So the argument is, as I understand it, not that an affidavit of mailing does not exist, but it does not the affiant did not include that in the affidavit of publication. That's the issue.
Your Honor, that may be the rare of the case. Appellant has never been served that affidavit, not in any of the pleadings before this court. While it may be in the e-file and serve system, and while the lower court judge may have accepted that document ex parte, my client has never received a copy of that pursuant to Rule 5. So we had brought that attention to the lower court, to the attention of the court, and the lower court did not rule on that except dismissing that as no constitutional violation. And I've addressed that in my initial briefing to this court. We were not served a number of documents throughout this process, and none of that was stricken from the record for reasons not fully explained to us.
And just to clarify, though, that you say that you brought a motion. Was that after the court made its findings? Did you ask for some amendment to those findings based on an error of what's in the record? I'm not quite following that. I thought we were just addressing the rule obligation, which requires an affidavit of mailing. The court made findings based on an affidavit of mailing in the record. So I assume, therefore, the issue for our court's review is simply whether the affidavit must be in the affidavit of publication as opposed to a standalone affidavit.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So even if the respondent can prove by preponderance of evidence that the appellant resides in Minnesota or is domiciled here, it is entirely irrelevant to the arguments of appellant. Furthermore, appellant recognizes that there are a number of cases that decide strict compliance with the rules of civil procedure is not necessary, but rather, and as respondent has argued, the court states substantial compliance is sufficient to satisfy due process. But it's very important for this court to recognize that none of those cases relate to service by publication. To the contrary, in 2016, the Supreme Court in Yeager versus Palladium Holdings overruled the constitutional analysis test relating to the rules of service of process set forth in O'Sell, which is also relied upon by the respondent. The court instead held that the rules governing service of process shall be strictly interpreted according to their plain language, regardless whether the intended recipient has received actual notice.
Mr. Huddle, go ahead. Judge Kay.
With regard to that point, are you arguing, or I understand your brief to say that the words resident individual domicilially don't need to be in the affidavit, that equivalent language is sufficient. Would you agree with that?
I would, Your Honor. Something to the effect.
And would you agree that the purpose is to make clear that the individual's permanent residence is in the state of Minnesota, the purpose of that language or something similar?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree with that point. The purpose of the affidavit and the statement with regard to resident individual domiciliary is a jurisdictional. Those are resident, individual, and domiciliary. There are elements of jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction in this court. And the attorney affidavit is a jurisdictional document that's submitted setting forth the jurisdiction of the court.
So with regard to the word domiciliary, in your reply brief, you argue that that's residence plus intent to stay is my understanding of your argument.
That is the law. That's the common law in our state, Your Honor, whereas the court has ruled in a number of periods over a considerable amount of time that it's not only that someone must maintain a residence here in Minnesota or some sort of connection to the state, but we also have an intent not to return if we leave. And that intent needs to be stated. If you're not going to use the word domicile, you have to somehow state what the intent of the party is to establish domicile in this state.
So isn't that really the equivalent of your permanent residence then?
Well, I guess permanent residence requires some sort of analysis by this court. I haven't exactly reviewed what a permanent residence means. We can have someone that maintains a permanent residence in the state of Minnesota, but is domiciled in Arizona because they're a snowbird. A permanent residence means to me that someone owns a home here. A place where you're domiciled would be where you subject yourself to the jurisdiction of the court, where you vote, where you conduct yourself so that you would return to that state.
Okay. No, that I appreciate that clarification, and that that's a point well taken. But then why aren't the facts in the affidavit sufficient to indicate domicile as you indicate or as you've explained it, given the indications in the affidavit that this is where appellant resides and has resided for a long time? It's his home. It's registered, it's owned by him as a homestead. He's been receiving mail there for quite some time.
Ultimately, it's the intent of the author, Your Honor, and nowhere in any of the pleadings does the intent of the author exemplify that those words have been meant to establish domicile. Basically, the court, the lower court, imputed that assertion into those words on behalf of the respondent. Had we had any indication that those words were set forth to in their lower court motion to for summary judgment, they never once they used the word domiciliary in describing 4.04, but never once used the word domicile in relationship to any of the words in their affidavit, merely just adding to the fact that the appellant has a residence here in Minnesota. Had they intended for those words to incorporate the word domicile, I would imagine that they would have briefed the court in the many briefings how those words relate to domicile, and so that the court could review that based upon the common law of the state.
Mr. Huddle, am I understanding your argument correctly to mean that if respondent had chosen the word domicile or domiciliary rather than omitting it, it would not have needed all those other facts? It could be a one statement affidavit that said appellant is a resident domiciliary, period. Well, whereas here, if I understand your point, there must be other facts, and you're arguing that these facts that were in there that Judge Cochran's referred to are not relevant to domiciliary?
They're relevant to residence. Absolutely, resident to relevant to residence.
And what case in particular, especially regarding if, well, I'm assuming there's no cases, or you would have cited it, identifying the phrase domiciliary for purposes of sufficiency of service.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. There are no cases that particularly point to this case. As a matter of fact, this is a relatively new in relationship to the common law in our state. The word domiciliary was added by the Supreme Court to this statute, to the Rule 4.04, only in the late 70s or early 80s. I'm not really sure of the history of this, because I could only check online what the history is. But in 1952, this Rule 4.04 was codified as a rule. But in the late 70s or early 80s, the word domiciliary was added to the rule, probably or because the Supreme Court felt that is an essential jurisdictional element to the entirety of the service by publication.
So if we conclude, though, agree with you that there needs to be additional facts identified if the word domiciliary is not used, or at least we can infer that perhaps from the civil rules of the rule itself, and we have those additional facts, is not, according to the Shamrock case, the burden on your client to refute that?
If in fact my client would admit all the facts that are in there, it still is not an assertion of domicile. And therein lies the chief argument of the appellant here.
But how? What case would you point us to that would tell us that those words in that affidavit and upon which the court made findings is not an assertion of domicile?
Shamrock, Your Honor. Shamrock specifically states that a plaintiff must explicitly assert the elements of the enumerated case they're invoking. They must add facts to those cases to support their assertion, and then those assertions must actually exist. And what we have here is a situation in which they've added facts, but no assertion.
But it's the Shamrock Court that confirmed, if I understand, and this is my question, and it's footnote number 4 of the decision. On the other hand, in cases involving the sufficiency of service, we have held that the defendant bears the burden of proof. So my question here is, what evidence did your client present that those allegations in the affidavit and upon which the court made findings are in error or are refuted?
The defendant can admit everything that's in that affidavit except for the hearsay statements therein. The defendant is merely saying those affidavit statements relate to he owns a residence in Minnesota and he uses Minnesota as a mailing address, but he has never admitted to being domiciled in the state, and no assertion had been made such in that affidavit.
I'm not quite following though. If the burden of proof is on your client, would it matter whether he's admitted or not? Would it not be important for him to deny that he lives there permanently?
The burden of proof would only be under circumstance in which an assertion has been under which he has to rebut. And there has been no assertion of domicile in this affidavit. And therein lies the problem. We can have all the putative evidence that we want about this residence and that the appellant owns this residence and uses it as a mailing address in Minnesota. There is nothing in that affidavit, even closely remote, about the intent of the appellant to remain in this state, or that Minnesota was even his domiciliary state in the first place.
Counsel, just following up on Judge Sleater's question, if the affidavit had stated that defendant is a resident individual domiciliary, would you agree then that the burden shifts to the defendant to show that that isn't the case?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and we would have briefed the lower court with regard to that as far as personal jurisdiction based on domiciliary status. Yes,
so thank you.
My time is up. Appreciate that.
All right, thank you. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready. And if you could briefly introduce yourself again, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes, if it please court, James Martin appearing on behalf of the respondent. My remarks are gonna be brief. My sense from the questioning so far is that nothing that I might say is gonna be revelatory. Shamrock, I think, is the case that dictates what the outcome should be here. And it's worth remembering that in Shamrock, the lower courts were reversed, but only because the trial court hadn't made a finding on the status of the defendant's place of abode, residence, or domicile. And that, so there was a remand, but we don't need to worry about that here because Judge Gruing made comprehensive findings as far as her memorandum is concerned. And of course the law is that a trial court's order accompanied by a memo, what's in the memo, constitute the findings. So
if I may, Mr. Martin, before we move off of Shamrock, because I had a question about that, which related to the last part of appellant's counsel's argument. So I'm looking at the Shamrock decision and it in page, I think it is 384. And so the decision says, okay, let's turn to the facts of this case. And it refers to the affidavit and then the affidavit of publication, and it was published. And then it says, once the plaintiff submits evidence of service, a defendant who challenges sufficiency of service has the burden of showing. So, which seems to, I think, track with what appellant's saying here is that he's saying there wasn't that initial, the affidavit didn't have that initial jurisdictional, evidence in there. So the burden never shifted to him. Could you address that? Because sure. I do get troubled by that language in Shamrock.
I've got that very same language highlighted right in front of me, Judge Jessen. And it is, once the plaintiff submits evidence of service, a defendant who challenges the sufficiency of service of process has the burden of showing that it was improper. So I read that sentence, Judge, as saying the plaintiff, in this case, Butler and Allen, came in and said, this is our case for service. Whether it was proper or not, is now the burden shifts to the defense to show that it was insufficient. And then I pick up on language from another opinion, this from the Court of Appeals, unpublished, but It was cited by the trial court, and it's worth reciting here. We reject appellant's argument as requiring a hyper-technical reading of the rule, and we hold that the language that respondent's attorney used effectively accomplished the same thing that using the exact language of the rule would have accomplished. And under the exact language of the rule, the attorney had two choices, and it goes on. And then I'll just say, concluding, furthermore, the affidavit language of the attorney did not in any way affect notice to the appellant, nor did it frustrate or thwart the purpose of service by publication. So, Your Honor, my view of this is that the purpose of the rule, which is to get the notice to the defendant to give him due process, was fully served here. And we know that that's the case because it's undisputed that the defendant received the suit papers, the documents that he was entitled to get, the documents that the rule said had to be sent to him. He got those materials no later than April the 10th of 2019, well before any answer was due. The evidence clearly shows that he took the opportunity to retain counsel. And then on the day after the statute of limitations ran on May the 12th, served an answer that says, ha ha, we got you. The statute of limitations is run and you didn't get proper service. So I believe, Your Honor, that the purpose of the rule was satisfied here, and that according to Judge Schumacher 10, 15 years ago, a hyper-technical language reading of the rule shouldn't defeat the notion proper service was obtained.
And I have the Maurer's case in front of me as well, Mr. Martin, but shouldn't we look at that decision, which is non-precedential, but kind of in light of a more recent decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court that says when it comes to service by publication, substantial compliance isn't enough.
And I don't disagree with that, but I don't think Maurer is at odds with that longstanding Minnesota Supreme Court rule either. And I think Shamrock is the proof in the pudding on that. We're willing to go down to the mat with on Shamrock. We think that that case fully supports Judge Gruing's decision, and that there's nothing that would be accomplished if there'd been a remand that we haven't already fully satisfied here with Sarah Quigley's 99 paragraph affidavit demonstrating all of the things that she did to show due diligence in an attempt to actually get this guy served. 12 attempts through the sheriff's office and through Metro Legal. He was clearly successfully avoiding service of process. That's one of the conditions. It's the one that we rely on from Rule 4. When the defendant is a resident individual domiciliary, having departed from the state with intent of defraud, that's not what we're claiming, or remains concealed therein with like intent. And that's the case. It's not a statement of belief. Her affidavit says, this is the circumstance. Here's what we did. Here's the summons and complaint. We mailed it to this fellow. He got it 7 days later. Case closed.
Mr. Martin, just to clarify then, in following that statement from Shamrock, since you're satisfied to rely upon that and the shifting of the burden, would you agree then, and you just quoted the language, and since we'll assume strict compliance is required in this situation, that your client did not include in the attorney affidavit of publication resident individual domiciliary. So the question for you is, on what basis can we conclude that requirement in Shamrock before the burden shifted to the defendant, evidence of service was made, absent that requirement in the rule?
I guess my response isn't any different than it was to Judge Jessen when I said that the Shamrock simply says, if the plaintiff comes in with evidence of service, then the burden shifts, period. Whether the evidence of service was sufficient or not is exactly the point that the defense is now obligated under Shamrock to come in and successfully challenge.
Also, I'd like to follow up on that for a minute, though. In Shamrock, the affidavit included the language resident individual domiciliary who has departed from Minnesota with intent to defraud creditors or avoid service or remains concealed within within the state. So it included the language that the rule required, and the defendant was challenging that. Here we don't have language, that same language. So I think you have to read the court's, that sentence in Shamrock that we've been focusing on, once the plaintiff submits evidence of service, in light of the evidence of service that was submitted in Shamrock, which is different than what we have here. So doesn't it make sense that the evidence would at least have to make a prima facie case of compliance with the rule before the burden would shift?
I don't accept that, Your Honor. And I don't think that the outcome here turns on the failure to use the word domiciliary and instead the use of the term residence. I don't think that that means that Judge Gruen got it wrong and that the case is should be dismissed. The substance here is that this fellow has always lived at all times relevant at Bayard. He doesn't dispute that fact. Judge Gruen had every right to draw an inference from the evidence before her of the intent, which counsel correctly indicates is an element of domiciliary, that there was the intent of permanent residency. So I'll say again that that is elevating form over substance to say that the word domiciliary's absence means that Judge Gruen got it wrong. And unless the court has other questions of me, I think that the Ocell decision that we cited in our brief shows that when there has been actual notice of the suit papers, that the due process requirements, which is what the rule is all about, are fully satisfied. Here we've got it undisputed. He knew he was being sued. He knew a long time before that he was going to get sued. And was prepared for it when it happened. So unless the court has other questions, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Hudala.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Martin. Mr. Hudala, any rebuttal?
Your Honors, the gist of the argument by respondent is that substantial service is sufficient in this case, since he goes back to a cytosol as a due process requirement, and the test of the constitutionality of the rules of civil procedure related to service of process, substantial compliance is enough. But the Supreme Court in Palladium, Niagara versus Palladium Holdings, overruled that decision in 2016, and that is not the case. Strict compliance with the rules is a requirement. We've seen this court and the Supreme Court in many cases on substitute service in Rule 4.03, whereas if substitute service is done improperly, even though the appellant or even though the defendant actually received notice, it wasn't sufficient and the case was dismissed. Here, the four corners of the attorney affidavit, which shall state the existence of one of the enumerated cases, omits a domiciliary statement and it omits a mailing attestation. Further, it incorporates hearsay evidence of diligence. Had they been tossed, had it been stricken by the court, would show, and ultimately my client can't even respond to the diligence because no evidence of diligence had been presented with regard to Metro Legal. If in fact Metro Legal, a reputable organization, certainly if they had actually made the attempts, would have put forth an admissible affidavit from the persons that actually attempted service. But in two attempts by that organization, neither is an admissible piece of evidence. And therefore, my client can only assert that those statements of diligence and attempts are not valid, and it never happened. But we can't put forth any other evidence other than say there is no evidence that actually occurred. So from a diligence standpoint, we're looking at four attempts over 5 days from February and 1 week in February to March of 2019, where the respondent had attempted service at an address that they actually don't even know if that's the domiciliary address of my client. And so So what we're asserting is, based upon the lower court decision using hearsay evidence to prove diligence, the fact that they dismissed that they had the phone numbers and work addresses of my client and made no further attempts to locate him in any other place than one residence that he owned in Minnesota, it doesn't show diligence. And the non-service attempts by a hearsay affiant are not admissible evidence. Further, we already know that the Supreme Court has stated that this document, the affidavit, that the attorney affidavit, is a jurisdictional document. The purpose of publication, purpose of the thwarting of the purpose of notice by publication is not the notice. The purpose of the attorney affidavit is to convey jurisdiction to the court based upon the elements required by the Supreme Court in the statute setting forth the conveying the jurisdiction. When that document is defective, jurisdiction is not conveyed. That is the argument of my client. The Supreme Court specifically put the word domiciliary in the statute because it is a central element to jurisdiction. And if because it omits two of the three requirements set forth in the statute, there's no attestation of mailing and the no domiciliary status, it's my client's position that personal jurisdiction never existed. And my client is, based upon Shamrock, is rebutting the evidence that jurisdiction ever existed. Not the basis of jurisdiction, but that jurisdiction itself, the procedure basis. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much both for your helpful arguments. We will take the matter under consideration and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.